WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nick Park and Peter Lord. They co-created and co-directed the new animated film Chicken Run. Park also created the Wallace and Gromit animated films. Chicken Run is a satire of prisoner of war movies in which chickens try to escape a barbed wire egg farm that is being converted into a chicken pot pie factory. Now, I have a confession to make. After seeing your movie and empathizing with these poor chickens, I ate a chicken dinner. Did I do the wrong thing?
Boy, what kind of movie is this? I'm sorry, no effect at all.
Did you find yourself shying away from eating chicken while you were making this?
No, actually, no. Rather the opposite. Our appetites were increased very healthily.
We were vegetarians before. But...
yeah. No, it is odd. No, I mean, Nick and I don't personally. We were on a plane yesterday. We both ordered the chicken. You know, we don't feel it at all, I have to say. But I thought maybe we were desensitized, whereas you, as a fresh viewer, might have the decency to hold off for a day at least.
I guess not. I guess the movie just wasn't powerful enough. Or I'm just too insensitive. Well, Nick Park, I have a question for you. Now, the new movie, Chicken Run. Chicken Run has a chicken pot pie machine, this insidious machine that the two mean-spirited humans have to bake these chickens into pot pies. And it's a bizarre contraption designed to take a whole chicken and mix it in with the chopped up peas and carrots and dough and spit them out the other end as a pot pie. And our hero and heroine have to escape their pot pie fate and get out of one of these machines. Now, Nick Park, most of your animations have bizarre contraptions of one sort or another in them. In fact, before I ask you the actual question, why don't you describe a couple of contraptions from your Wallace and Gromit movies?
Right. What from? You mean a close shave?
Sure.
There's the wrong trousers, which are ex-NASA, in fact, that are actually bought from an ex-NASA store in Wallace's neighborhood, and Wallace uses them to. They're covered in rivets. They're very round and robust and have a sort of 1940s feel. And I guess same too with the Knitomatic machine in A Close Shave. That's all covered in copper sheeting and rivets and that kind of thing. And lots of arms and lots of Jules Verne, you know, H.G. Wells and Victorian technology, I like to describe it as.
Yeah, and like the Knitomatic, you put a whole sheep in one end of the machine, and out comes yarn, and by the end of the machine, I think a little sweater is coming out. These bizarre contraptions. Now, your father was an inventor. Did he make contraptions?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think I would describe him as an inventor, but he did make a lot of things. He spent his time in the shed making things.
What kinds of things?
Well, a lot of household things, you know, just shelves, that kind of thing.
Made that caravan. Did you make a caravan?
Oh, that's right, yes. That's what made, after making the first Wallace and Gromit film, A Grand Day Out, I realised one day, he's so much like Wallace, because I recalled this childhood experience where my father built a trailer, you know, from scratch. It was like just a room on wheels, like a living room on wheels, and with beds inside, and made everything, and wallpapered it with furniture, and it had furniture and chairs and all that kind of thing. And the whole family, seven of us, went on holiday in this caravan.
Were you taken to any unusual factories when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, boy! I had this terrible experience of going to a chicken slaughterhouse. When I was a kid. I was actually a student at the time. I was doing a summer job, and I was working at a chicken packing factory, folding up plucked chickens and putting them onto trays and feeding them into this great big machine that wraps them for the supermarket. And actually, one day I was sent down to the slaughterhouse, because they were short of labour there, and saw some pretty horrific things there. And some of those ideas from both those experiences have actually come through and been used in Chicken Run.
Your characters of Wallace and Gromit, which are so popular now, tell us if you kind of patterned them on anyone you knew, either in real life or in the movies. And I should say Wallace is a man who's a British man who's very stuffy and proper sounding, but in reality he's really not very bright. Gromit is his dog, and the dog is the smart one who reads books like The Republic by Pluto. So who's behind these characters?
Boy, I mean, I don't think I ever really consciously based them on anybody particularly. Wallace, perhaps, you know, when I think about it, you know, for reasons that I've given, he is very close to my dad, who, was very, he was like an inventor and made things. But I think it's his attitude, actually, the way he'll just get ideas and go about doing them without thinking. And he'll be, my dad isn't insensitive, but Wallace is very insensitive and another influence, actually, he's very much like an old music hall character that's very much known in Britain, in the north, comes from the north of England, who plays a banjo, ukulele, and called George Formby. And he was very popular, I think, before the Second World War. And he's got a very similar accent and very similar attitude to Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't very conscious, you know, to base him. He isn't based on him, but I think these influences have found themselves in Wallace.
Did you have pets as a kid? Did you have a dog?
I never ever had a dog. Funny you should say that, though. We had a pet chicken.
Did you really?
It was our family dog.
Why did you have a pet chicken?
It was my sister's, actually. It was called Penny, this great big Rhode Island Red. And we just had it for the eggs, really. But it used to come in the porch, and we used to throw sticks for it and things like that. Never went and fetched them, but it was very much a pet. And we saw, my sister and I saw such character in that chicken. And we used to write short stories about this chicken, and one or two ideas have actually found themselves in Chicken Run, like Rocky being known as the Lone Free Ranger. That was a joke we had as a kid.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah, but we never had a dog.
Huh. Did you always want to make cartoons when you were young? Did you see those old cartoons and thought, I want to do that too?
Yeah. I just watched everything and took it all in. I had no idea how they were made, and so they always had an intrigue and a mystery to me. And I remember actually seeing a documentary about Walt Disney and how the whole thing started, with this little drawing of a mouse. And I used to doodle characters in my books at school and stuff, and I used to secretly dream that one day my characters would be known on the screen. In fact, I remember the first time I met Pete was at a film festival, and Pete has actually created this character called Morph, who's very big in Britain. He's like the British equivalent of Gumby, and he metamorphosizes into different things. And when I first met Pete, he had a badge on his lapel with Morph on it. And I just thought, how cool is that? Having a badge that you can buy in the shops of your own character. I thought, wow.
Right, yeah, it's like something in your mind becoming a reality, this totally imaginary thing becoming a reality for so many people. At the end of Wallace and Gromit films, at least at the end of a couple of them, Wallace always yearns for some cheese. So why don't we end our interview with finding out about cheese? Why why does Wallace want cheese?
Well, how do ideas come about? I think the single reason there's cheese, because it all starts when Wallace and Gromit go to the moon to find cheese, and I was trying to think of a reason why they would go to the moon. And then, you know, we record the voices first, and I recorded with Peter Salis, the actor who plays Wallace. It's just the way he said, cheese, Gromit. And that made such a nice mouth shape for Wallace. It was such a nice thing to have him get his chops around, that cheese stuck, and it appeared in all the other movies. In fact, there's a very short little story that there's a factory in the north of England that makes a type of cheese called Wensleydale cheese. And we made Wallace say Wensleydale one in the third film in a close shave. And just by doing that, it actually put... The cheese factory was on its last legs and about to go into liquidation. And it put the cheese factory back in business.
You're kidding.
And,
that's funny.
The Wensleydale Cheese Factory.
Well, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Nick Park and Peter Lord co-directed the new animated film Chicken Run. Nick Park also created the Wallace and Gromit animated shorts. Here's the scene Park mentioned that saved the cheese factory. It's from the latest Wallace and Gromit film, A Close Shave. Wallace is talking to his lady friend, Wendoline Ramsbottom.
You're very kind.
Oh, why'd you come in? We were just about to have some cheese.
Oh, no, not cheese. Sorry, it brings me out in a rash. Can't stand the stuff.
Not even Wensleydale.
Got to be on our way. Come on, Preston. Goodbye. Chuck.
What's wrong with Wensleydale?
Coming up, jazz performances from classic films. This is Fresh Air. The first talking motion picture in 1927 was called The Jazz Singer. There was no jazz in it. Critic Kevin Whitehead says the relationship between jazz and the movies hasn't improved much since, even with such directors as John Cassavetes, Clint Eastwood, and Woody Allen giving jazz a shot. But if Hollywood rarely takes the music seriously, there has been a bit of good jazz in the movies, often made by musicians turning up briefly in non-jazz films. Kevin reviews a new anthology of hot music from the movies.
New York on Sunday, big city taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday. Life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap. If you've got troubles.
In John Gregory Dunn's book, The Studio, about life at 20th Century Fox in the 1960s. There's a scene where a luckless director pitches a story to a producer. The pitch went something like, a temperamental Russian orchestra leader comes to New York to conduct a benefit concert for crippled children, but then the orchestra's quarantined and he wants to cancel, but wait, there's this ragtag bunch of student musicians maybe he could try. The conductor's against it, but the kids win him over, only there aren't enough of them. So he goes out to weird nightclubs and rounds up some jazz musicians. But then the quarantine is lifted and the conductor has to decide whether to use the ragtag students and jazz musicians or the... Somehow, that story says way too much about jazz in the movies. It's rarely confronted head-on, more often used to provide a little comic relief, urban atmosphere, or a late-night mood. Jazz-loving moviegoers have favorite films on the topic. Mine include 1941's Blues in the Night, we just heard Jimmy Lunsford in an outtake from the film, as well as the amiably absurd Gene Krupa story and Martin Scorsese's meditation on art versus entertainment, New York, New York. When even your top jazz films include guilty pleasures, you know Hollywood's done something wrong. That feeling is reinforced by a new 2-CD anthology of music dredged from Ted Turner's vaults. It's called Hollywood Swingin' Jazz, Hot Numbers from Classic MGM, Warner Brothers, and RKO Films, spanning the years 1934 to 66. Still, there is a lot of good stuff here.
Did you hear what the lady said? Not exactly. What'd she say? She say, I got a snap in my finger. Yeah. And a rhythm in my walk. You don't tell me. As the elephant say, living in a great big way. Oh, get away from here. That's too much. I got a handful of nothing. What? But I peep at it like a hawk. Peep at nothing? I'm doing okay. Living in a great big way. Tell me more, tell me more. Listen here, sir. I'm the salt in the ocean. I'm the sun in the sky. I'm a Franklin D. Roosevelt. Not the president. I'm a $1 million. Long as I've got snap in my finger. I'll stop. And a rhythm in my walk. Get away from here. I got the devil to pay. I'm living in a great big way. Well, let me tell you something. What is it? Gotta snap my finger. Yeah, yeah.
Bill Bojangles Robinson and Thomas Fats Waller from 1935's Hooray for Love. The mini box Hollywood Swing and Jazz includes music from full-length features and from a few shorts, notably the classic performance film Jammin' the Blues from 1944. Elsewhere, Duke Ellington and Count Basie turn up, the latter with a stripped-down octet from the soundtrack to Made in Paris. A castle of good singers appear, from the Mills Brothers and Louis Armstrong, to Hoagie Carmichael and Lena Horne, to Carmen McRae and Mel Torme. Those singers include the cat who brought more relaxed jazz feeling to the movies than any other screen star, Bing Crosby. This standout is from 1956's High Society.
Dear gentlefolk of Newport, or maybe I should say hats and cats, I want you to lend an ear because, I want you to hear some really shimmering sharps and flats. For these cozy virtuosi, just about the greatest in the trade, are fixing to show you now precisely how, or approximately, jazz music is made. Well, you take some skins, jazz begins, and you take a bass. Man, now we're getting someplace. Take a box, one that rocks. Take a blue horn, New Orleans barn. Ah, you take a stick with a lick. Take a bone. Oh, hold the phone. Take a spot, cool and hot. Now you have jazz, 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 jazz. Little don't sound.
As much good and sometimes rare material this set contains, it could have been better. The booklet notes are long on capsule biographies of jazz greats and a little short on production anecdotes or discussion of how the music is used in specific films. The selections come off a bit arbitrary as well. We get two set pieces from Cabin in the Sky, but not Ethel Waters singing Happiness is a Thing Called Joe, which was written for the film. We get one good Pearl Bailey number from All the Fine Young Cannibals, but not Robert Wagner's classic bit where he demonstrates how he emotes on his trumpet. We get nine pieces from Andre Previn's score to The Subterraneans, far more than from any other film. But actually, that's okay. It features some of the West Coast jazz musicians who invaded studio orchestras in the 50s and 60s, resulting in more and better used jazz in Hollywood, if only temporarily. Well, with a set like this, you take your pleasures where you can and block out the rest, which is pretty much what jazz fans do at jazz movies already.
Hey, Pops, you want to grab a little of what's left here?
Yeah, Daddy, yeah.
Here we go. If you sail...
I sail in sailing...
Over the sea...
Or will you wait for me?
Take my tip, they're all mold of hip in Italy.
Or will Averaduce ask for France?
Oh, I know you'll never make this.
Yes, believe it or not.
I do believe, I do indeed.
The Frenchmen's all prefer what they call leges high.
Pull me down, take a plane.
Oh, Babadoozat.
Go to Siam.
Babadoozat.
In Bangkok today, round the clock, oh, well, they all like to jam. Indians on the Amazon. Beat one bar and all of them are.
Well, gone, man, gone.
From the equator up to the pole. Everybody winging, everybody singing that rock, 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 rock and roll. From the east to the west. From the coast to the coast, jazz is king, jazz is the thing the folks dig. That's jazz.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Hollywood Swing and Jazz on Rhino Records. Coming up, David Bianculli on British TV shows that have come to America. This is Fresh Air.